Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the novel The Scarecrows by Robert Westall. A transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, and a hot and balmy evening it is too.
Oh,
well, it is here in Suffolk. How is it up in Scotland?
Moderately grey, I'd say. Yeah, we haven't had much in the way of heat since June.
Oh, so, gosh.
It's mostly been raining.
Yeah, it's been clammy here. And I've got a question before we really get into the thicker things with our discussion of Robert Westall's The Scarecrows. I have a question for you that's arisen, and I thought, well, Ren's going to know the answer. Okay. Ren, what is an old-fashioned expression?
I did notice that came up in this, yeah. I mean, I can picture it, but I don't know if I can describe it.
What are you picturing?
I mean, I think it's something like a kind of sceptical expression, a kind of reserved expression, a kind of... That's what I think of it being, at least. A kind of restrained scepticism.
Okay. Like, I mean, I assumed... It must be an expression that they made on the musical stage. I guess. But it came up more than once in this book with different characters making an old-fashioned expression. I was like, I've got no idea what that means.
Yeah, I mean, what I always think when that phrase comes up is like a kind of Victorian governess. That's what I think is an old-fashioned expression.
So, like, because they are the quintessential old-fashioned person.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Or maybe like someone's channeling the spirit of a Victorian governess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, when I next hear that expression, it's not an expression I hear often, but if I hear someone at school say, oh, that child made an old-fashioned expression at me, I'll assume that they are suggesting they were channeling the spirit of a Victorian governess.
I realise that as you asked this, that I had a very clear idea of what that phrase meant with, like, nothing to back that up. That's just what I've been...
Well, to be fair, that is exactly why I asked you, because I was like, I'm sure Red has a clear idea of what this phrase means. So I'm glad my suspicion is correct. But yeah, I have no idea. But that is one phrase amongst many... curious phrases that one can indeed...
curious book.
That the brave and intrepid reader can encounter in Robert Westall's Carnegie-winning The Scarecrows, which won the Carnegie Children's Literature Medal for 1981, I believe.
Yeah. It's a medal for outstanding books for children and young people. Other winners include Watership Down, Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, The Borrowers, The Owl Service by Alan Garner, and Goggle Eyes by Anne Fine, which is actually the book that this reminded me of in parts.
Oh, that's not an Anne Fine I've read, actually.
It's only because it's about the protagonists. It's about the protagonist's mother... getting together with a new man,
And presumably the protagonist of Goggle Eyes doesn't like the new stepdad.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Because Simon Wood, the protagonist of The Scarecrows, really, really, really freaking hates his new stepdad.
Yeah, yeah.
this is a book of fairly incandescent rage.
Yeah. Yeah, but before we go further, what cover do you have?
Oh, no, yeah, I do like discussing the covers. Okay, so I have this quite murky cover. It's a painting of a very sort of purple, brown and green turnip field with three scarecrows that look very scraggy and gaunt, sticking up out of it with sort of blue cloud-strewn sky and some crows flying about. And it's by Sophie Williams, apparently.
I have a different one, which is sort of 70s kind of earth tones and has a kind of surprised-looking boy with a bowl cut surrounded by three scarecrows. And kind of the one behind him has a cap over its face, but you can just see sort of straw coming up out of it, so it looks quite maggoty.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's one sort of facing towards him, but away from the reader, who is wearing a... That's the sort of female one, I suppose. And then the last one is, like, very close up, and it's kind of... It has, like, sort of two-thirds of his face, and is wearing this kind of russet-brown balaclava and has a braided straw moustache and beard.
Oh, it sounds a bit gnarly.
Yeah, it's a very intense expression on this scarecrow's face. this one's by Alan Hood. Yeah, Puffin Plus edition. I don't know what Puffin Plus means.
It means you've got through the regular puffins, and now you're ready for the hard stuff.
For the weird stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kit, you can imagine, like, you know, the book, hey kid, you know, you want the hard stuff. Yeah. Have I got the book for you? This is the first book we've discussed in which we're probably going to censor ourselves, basically, and have to talk around certain areas, because even though this won a children's literature award, I think it's fair to say it's got some troubling stuff in it.
Yeah, we were talking about Roald Dahl and sensitivity readers last time. And I feel like, I mean, I don't know, my copy's a 1986 edition. I feel fairly confident that if there are more recent editions, it's gone through something of a toning down in the process.
Yeah, I feel like most sensitivity readers would just sort of say, nope. If I'm honest.
Yeah, yeah, and as Adam said, we won't go into everything because it is, it's a bit much, honestly. It's a bit much for the podcast.
And it's tricky because part of me, there's some great stretches of writing in this, right?
Yeah.
And it's trying to get into the head of a very angry and confused 13-year-old boy. And frankly, this 13-year-old boy is angrier than I ever was. He's really angry. But, you know, I'm sure there are some kids who've read this and found it really comforting and relatable. And, you know, it doesn't shy away from really difficult, weird emotions. And I do think that's something that great young adult fiction, children's fiction can do. That said, I wouldn't give this to my coming up to 12-year-old stepson.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be okay with him reading it, if I'm absolutely honest.
Yeah,
it's a little bit, without going into it, it's a little bit of a Freudian fever dream in places.
yeah.
Also, yeah, just some off the cuff 70s vintage homophobia going on.
Oh, yeah.
Multiple uses of the puffish as an adjective.
Yeah. So this book's a lot.
How did you, where did you get this from? Where did you...
Well, this old man came up to me in an alley, opened his brown Mac, and said, hey kid. I think I must have just looked up scariest young adult fiction, to be honest. It was probably one of the lists, various lists I've read of creepy children's books, to be honest, and I assumed it would be a folk horror, and there are elements of that in this, in as much as someone from outside the country going into the country, and there are slightly eccentric country folk to a degree. And it's certainly about old, ancient, hidden secrets coming back, and the pull of the earth and the land to a degree, and turnips.
It's definitely about turnips. It's
definitely about turnips. Turnips are a very... they're very symbolic in this book. I have no idea of what, but they're definitely a symbol. I know that much.
Yeah.
because there's a lot of turnips, like just scattered throughout. It'll be like, you know, the turnip heir. He sat down upon the turnip seat and nodded his turnip head.
I wondered if you related it. I remember you lived near a cabbage field.
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but they're not everywhere. Like, I don't go out the door and see cabbages all the time. Like, you might smell the cabbage field and be like, ugh, cabbagey. Yeah. Yeah, they don't occupy my consciousness in quite the same.
Yeah.
But anyway, because the people, listeners are going to have a sense of what's the mystery of this very strange book.
So it starts, it was the night before the fundraising effort that the devils came, so it seemed to Simon Wood ever after. And we kind of get right into the horror with a dormitory full of 13-year-old boys at a boarding school.
And I thought we'd had enough of this kind of stuff with Roald Dahl last time.
I know. Like, coming right after The Swan, I was like, oh, God, do we have to? this is just right in with this bully, Bowden, who's choosing his victims and sort of throwing various insults at other boys' parents. And
like really unpleasant your mama jokes.
Yeah, really, really nasty stuff. And... like, luckily, the book changes direction. He goes away for the holidays, because I couldn't handle a whole book of this kind of horrible boys in a boarding school stuff. He sort of Bowden's and starts in on Simon's mum, who was playing tennis at the kind of previous parents' day. And this is when the devils come for Simon for the first time, and he kind of gets out of bed and attacks Bowden. I was thinking of reading a bit of this. That was when the devils came. Simon got out of bed without willing it, felt the floor cold under his feet like in a dream, walked steadily across to Bowden's bed. He knew he was being insane. Bowden was twice his size. Bowden would kill him. Calmly, he reached for Bowden in the dark, got hold of his pyjama coat. "Hey, what's up with you?" said Bowden, querulously. Simon hit him with all his strength. He could remember nothing after that, except Bowden wrenching and heaving under his hand, and Bowden's pyjamas tearing, and chairs falling, and the iron pane of bed legs and slithering on the smooth polished floor, and then nothing. Until he was standing in the washroom, with the lights on. Something was dripping off his nose and splashing on the floor. He looked down. There was a track of blood all down his pyjamas right to the crotch, and one of the toilet doors stood half open with its lock smashed off. He gaped stupidly at the splintered star of bare wood in the blue door. Who did that? You did, my lad, said a grim voice above his head. So that's the first instance of the devils, where he attacks Valden. But Simon's not, he's not really a hard lad. He's an angry lad, but he's not a hard lad.
Yes. Yeah.
He reads Watership Down to calm himself down, and he has a soft spot for cats, as we find out later. But when the devils get into him, he kind of loses control of himself. At the next parents' day, his mum shows up with a man who Simon describes as a yob, but is revealed to be a somewhat well-known artist and political cartoonist called Joe Morton.
And Simon idealises his father, who died in combat, possibly in the Second World War? Or afterwards? I wasn't quite sure it took me a while to try to work out when exactly.
I think it must have been after.
Place.
I think it's written in the mid 70s. I think it's set in the mid 70s based on later when they find a newspaper from the Second World War, and he says that it was 30 years ago. And it also says that his father's grave is in a military cemetery where Arab children can see in. So I assume it's somewhere in the Middle East. I don't know military history well enough to know
which
war that would have been in the 60s or the.
So it says here Simon Wood's father was a hero, a commanding officer in the British Army. I guess that's the essential information.
Dad
was a commanding officer in the army and has died in combat, and Simon really idealises his father.
Yeah. And his mum knows this and is kind of trying to keep the information that she's dating Joe sort of a bit quiet from him, although it seems fairly obvious. And kind of when he's kind of home for the holidays and kind of goes to a gallery opening to see where his mum has been spending all her time, and it turns out it's an exhibition of Joe's drawings.
I kind of pictured Joe's drawings as a bit like Gerald Scarfe's.
I don't think I know that.
Is that how is it the guy, the political cartoonist who did like the famous cover for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and also
the
art in The Wall, the Pink Floyd movie.
Yeah. I think that's definitely what he's going for. I've got a description of one of his drawings. It's the Chancellor of the Exchequer was made up from a jumble of dollar signs and trade graphs. Behind him was the Bank of England, all falling down and twisted. It was just a jumble of pen strokes close to you, but if you stepped back, it looked just like him as he appeared on telly, all efficient and sensible on top and dead scared underneath. All Joe Morton's people looked scared underneath, like the people at Granny's funeral. It made you feel scared yourself, as if nothing in the world was what it seemed. Yeah, Simon really dislikes Joe's Joe's drawings. He finds that they expose too much, and it makes him uncomfortable.
Yeah, Joe clearly his art is about upending the establishment. Although, as often the way with satire, the establishment also kind of love him.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, clearly this is really offensive on some level to Simon, and it seems like he's kind of degrading or insulting his father and what his father stood for.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of at this gallery opening, he overhears a couple of people talking about his mother and Joe, and the next time his mum comes to visit, she tells him that she and Joe are getting married and going to live in Joe's old house in Cheshire with Simon's little sister Jane. And obviously Simon doesn't take this news well, and he kind of tries to avoid going back for the summer holidays and goes to a kind of some sort of army thing with like a man who was a friend of his dad's, but eventually has to go home and he kind of sees Joe settled in as part of the family.
I'm glad you have no idea what this army thing was either.
Yeah, no, not a clue. I'm just like, okay.
Army camp.
He went and did some army for a bit and then he left. Well, no. Yeah, no, it's it's Aldershot. He says it's Aldershot, so it's a kind of army training barracks kind of thing. Yeah. betraying my lack of interest in
well, Robert Westall clearly is quite interested in the war,
yeah,
right, and both world wars, because a lot of his other books are war based.
Mm-hmm,
So the only other one I know, which I bought for George, was Blitz Cat.
Okay,
because I was like, oh, it combines war with cats, so that's a shoo-in for George. He'll like it. And a cute cat, you know, in the wreckage of the Blitz.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that investment in, don't say the army necessarily, but Britain's role in the wars and army life colours this book in an interesting way, because it's very hard. Okay, so Simon is really angry and often has these bursts of violence, and he has a lot of very dark, angry thoughts, and so sometimes he can be quite alienating as a protagonist. But Robert Westall clearly puts a lot of effort, very convincingly, getting inside Simon's head. And Simon really believes in the values of the British Empire and what that represents, but also stoicism and the British fighting spirit and all of these things that kind of part and parcel of that and this ideology. Mm-hmm. And Joe Mortimer obviously is very mocking of this, and so Simon sees Joe as this sort of grotesque, kind of cowardly court jester, basically. You know, he's not man enough to go and fight himself, but will stand sneering on the sidelines, basically. Mm. And it's really ambiguous, I think, which makes it interesting and sometimes a difficult book to sit with, where Robert Westall, as the author, sits on that.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely not a straightforward book where we realise Simon is completely wrong and Joe, actually, this anti-authority figure, is the hero all along, right? And his idealisation of kind of traditional patriotic and masculine values was mistaken. I really don't think that's what the book's doing. Which, while would probably be closer to my own sensibilities, at the same time would make for a lot less interesting a book.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah, but also Simon is so unpleasant that you can't fully
Well, you wouldn't want to be Simon, right?
Yeah.
Simon's consumed by hatred pretty much all the time. Being in Simon's head, it's a tough book to read because being in Simon's head is not a nice place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pretty like kind of powerful moment later where Joe draws him and kind of reflects that hatred back at him. Shows him as this like kind of goblin figure consumed by hate, and he can't bear to look at it.
But he has to move in over the holidays. He has to move in to Joe's farmhouse, I suppose you'd say.
When he sort of sees Joe kind of acting kind of as part of the family, he sort of feels the devil's return in him, and he runs out the house across the turnip field, starring role of the turnip field in this book, and finds the old mill. And in the old mill, there's an old front room with a newspaper from 1943 that kind of crumbles to flakes as he touches it. And a sort of an old bitten pipe, and then he kind of feels as if he's being watched, but it's only these three old coats and hats hanging on pegs, and two men's and one woman's, and he kind of tries them on and parades up and down and feels that like the old inhabitants of the room sort of don't mind him doing this, and they kind of are becoming friendlier to him as he tries on their clothes. And but yeah, he kind of goes to explore the rest of the mill, and do you want to read the bit where you see it kind of sees the hanging
the hanging coats?
Oh, the hanging figure. It's like page 51. It says where he thinks he sees a man hanging.
Okay. It wasn't totally dark. As his eyes adjusted, he could see several rows of faint blue, horizontal slits set into the walls, and the blue light bounded round, picking out corners of great wooden wheels and axles. Only the mill machinery. Nothing to be afraid of. Then he saw the blonde man hanging, from a rope round his neck. Legs dangling, body swaying gently in the breeze that came out of the dark and passed through the body behind Simon. Simon felt his whole body go rigid, felt his knuckles go to his mouth, felt his teeth bite on them, bottling up a scream. Woods did not run. Father, he thought, and walked towards the hanged man. Touched him. In the moment he touched, everything changed shape. It was far too light to be a hanged man. A sack. 32 years ago, the miller had hauled a sack of grain up on a hoist and left it hanging that last day. Over the years, the sack had dampened, rotted, burst, spilling the grain on the floor. Now the burst bottoms of the sack dangled down in rags, making the hanged man's legs. And over the years, the rope had chafed half through. Two pale strands of frayed hemp hung loose, making the hanged man's hair. And animals had come and eaten the grain lying beneath, leaving only a clotted black mess. So simple. But he still ran back into the living room and slammed the door on the mill. He wasn't interested in the workings of the mill, he told himself.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some good textures in this book.
Oh, well, in fact, my textures are mill-based, so should we do textures?
Okay, shall we?
Yeah, if I don't want to knock my microphone onto the floor, I just want to grab this.
Right, one moment. I'm going to get my drumsticks.
Texture of the week.
Texture of the week. Yeah.
Crispy Grangle. Okay, so...
Yeah, I wondered if you had picked the mill.
I have. In fact, I've picked the second of Simon's visits to the mill where he actually gets the water wheel moving, which is in great sounds, so I won't read all of it, but it says water was running into the mill all over, different sounds of rushing waters like little waterfalls. Then the noise of a dustbin being rolled by bin men right beneath his feet, a dustbin 2 inches thick. Then tong, 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 tong. A noise like a boy rattling an iron bar along iron railings. Entranced, he moved about. The sounds changed as he moved, went deeper, roaring like a lion chained up underground, water going like a heart beating, rumbles like indigestion inside his own body, so deep down were they. Again, like the blood pounding in his own ears. But the actual texture at the end of this sort of series of auditory descriptions that I really liked focuses on the cogwheels and, the thick grease on the cogwheels was like blue-black butter.
Ooh.
Yeah, if it was just black butter, I don't think it'd be nearly as effective as blue-black butter.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's my texture.
That's good. Yeah, no, that passage was one of the ones I picked out as well. But as you've done the mill, I will do turnips.
The texture of turnip.
Yeah. He could see nothing but turnips, a field of turnips growing in neat geometric rows as far as the eye could see, their geometry only broken by pale random fringes of weed. The turnips were in full leaf, purple, blue, grey, full of darker blue shadows. The wind coming across them lifted their undersides in silvery waves. They whispered together like friends. Somehow he felt they were happy. The smell of turnips soothed him.
Oh, it's like Wordsworth with his daffodils.
They whisper together like friends. Oh, yeah, it's really charming. I feel like he spent a lot of time looking at turnips for this.
Do you think he had a turnip on his writing desk?
I think so, at least one. But yeah, it's a very good writer.
But why spend it on so much anger? Simon goes to the old mill and he's kind of both entranced and repulsed by it.
Yeah.
He feels compelled to go into it even though it scares him. And then the rest of the family go and tromp around it. Joe leaves his big footprints around the mill, so next time Simon goes, he sweeps away or...
Yeah.
I don't know what the right word is. Swibbles? That's not a word. Swibbles up, swooshes up the footsteps.
And Joe says that when he was a kid, his mother made him swear on a Bible not to go up to the mill, just so we get a bit of a bit more dread in there. The next day Simon goes back to the mill and on a whim kind of pulls the big lever to start it up.
And that's where you get all the amazing sounds that I read out.
Yeah. he stops it again, but he just has a little go. And he meets this old man sitting in a wheelbarrow called Tom Merciful, who was a First World War veteran, because, we're still in a time where there were First World War veterans around. And even if they were rather elderly. And he sort of, I don't know, what does he do? He talks about his father being a horsebreaker, for breaking in horses. Just sort of is generally a bit eccentric.
I quite like the fact that he's given room to breathe. He's given these quite rambling monologues about life in the country, but I do think they added a bit of texture to the setting.
Yeah.
And he's quite an odd figure, like, you don't really know which way to take him.
Like, yeah, we do get some interesting characters in this book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, a lot of characters where you're not quite sure how you're meant to take them, and lots of potential caricatures for Joe, in fact. Like, one thing I like about having the character of Joe, it is Joe, isn't it? Yeah, Joe Morton.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that it then meant that when we were introduced to these slightly eccentric characters, I was kind of immediately picturing how Joe would draw them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good dynamic, isn't it? So, yeah, kind of Simon's sort of spending all his time kind of lurking in his attic bedroom, avoiding the family, and he realises there's a kind of spot in his cupboard where he can listen in on his mum and Joe, who are sort of generally despairing about Simon and say things like, he's so bloody lonely it fills the whole house, like the smell of a leaky lav. he also listens in on them having sex.
So this whole stuff becomes very odd and voyeuristic, basically.
Yeah.
It made me think a bit of, you know, that Simpsons episode which is based on Rear Window, where Bart ends up shut away in his bedroom, like, and goes a bit weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it made me think of that.
very much that kind of vibe.
Like, Simon just gets quite strange and voyeuristic, shut away. And, like, as soon as he finds this crack, it's like, you know, he's like, I can't go to it. And then it's like the next minute, he's his ears to it, listening all through the night. Oh, dear.
Yeah, he's not doing great, is Simon?
No.
Yeah.
I think that's what's quite startling about this book, actually, is, you know, as a young adult, and you have all these very texted descriptions, and then sometimes, suddenly as an adult reader, your mind just goes back to, oh my gosh, he's really not doing well. There's a bit later where he gets hold of his dad's gun, and he, like, loads it up, and you're like, frickin' heck.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you really do think, is he actually going to just shoot someone? Like, there definitely is that level of potential violence in this book. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, but also, like, but I think, yeah, Robert Westall puts in the whole bit about the cat as well to kind of leaven that a bit. I mean, to show that he's not just a complete...
He has goodness in him. He's got some compassion. He's just very angry. So he rescues this sort of scrawny, underfed cat, and him and his family help nurse her back to health.
Yeah, and their kittens, and Before he gets hold of the gun, he kind of gives his mum and Joe a scare by setting up his father's old army kit by the side of their bed, to remind his mum that his dad, well, he says, to remind you he still exists, you whore, he says.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if we were going to quote it.
Yeah, I mean...
he doesn't just say it once, he shouts it repeatedly at his own mum.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't ever read a kid's book in which the protagonist shouts that at their own mum over and over again.
I know. I have to remind the listeners, this is still us not... kind of editing out the most troubling parts of this book, so...
That's not even the heavy stuff. You know, as a teacher, obviously, I'm now like, right, that's the purple forms, you know, this is all the safeguarding stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Sir Simon would be having lots of long conversations in the support centre, basically.
Yeah.
I do wonder if smart therapy would be good for him, actually. But I think he'd probably be quite resistant to that, sadly.
Yeah, he's quite opposed to art at this point. Yeah, and he doesn't really have anyone to talk about this with. I mean, the closest was like the army guy, but the army guy is doing his army things in Aldershot, and isn't really a feelings person anyway.
I mean, I guess what makes the book interesting and maybe valuable is the fact that there's so much endlessly written, right, about toxic masculinity now and incels and, you know, getting into the heads of violent young men. And in some ways, I do think this book does quite a good job of that. And there's something kind of grim and tragic about the fact that there's so much violence in this book, right? So, you know, Joe and his mother are sometimes sympathetic, but ultimately, when they're despairing of someone, they react with violence too. You know, both Joe and his mum hit Simon, and his mum seemingly quite viciously, actually. You're not saying any hitting is okay, but there's a really distressing sequence in which his mum sort of hits him over and over and over again. And so, yeah, it's a really bleak book in many ways about this deeply troubled young man who is sort of trying to connect and largely kind of, you can only, there's just violence. It's a very violent book. Which makes it really claustrophobic. It's not an easy read.
Yeah, and that's before we get into the violent story of the scarecrows / the people of the mill.
Oh my gosh, which is actually really, I always forgot how grim that is.
Really horrible, yeah. And sort of
like something from a freaking Junji Ito manga.
Yeah, it really is. So one of the curiosities, another curiosity of this book is that the scarecrows themselves don't turn up until
2/3 through, almost.
Yeah, or more. Yeah. but we get their foreshadowing with the abandoned room in the mill and the cloves on the back of the door.
The book should be called The Very Angry Young Man and the Scarecrows That Represented His Anger.
Yeah. I mean, should it not just be called, like, The Devils? Would
that... Yeah, that'd be a much better title.
Because quite a lot of the reviews on Goodreads are like, well, the scarecrows don't even turn up until
Wow, it's true.
And it's like, well, yeah.
And they're on all the freaking covers.
Yeah.
You know, there's more turnips than scarecrows in this book.
Yeah. But where the scarecrows actually come in is that sort of after this kind of explosion of anger at his mum, he kind of runs out into the night, into the turnip field, and kind of calls out to his father. And he's like, you know, help me, come and help me. But the book kind of makes it, it's very clear that it's not his father's spirit that's coming to him. It's the devil's. And the next morning, the scarecrows appear in the turnip field.
Wearing the clothes.
Yeah, wearing the clothes. It says, two male, one female. The front male was big and burly. The female stood beside him, just on his right. The other male was much further back. So they kind of have this hierarchy of the scarecrows, of their position is significant. The kind of one behind, it says, his head was tipped facing down at the ground. His cap was pulled well down over where his eyes should have been. He had no face at all, just shadows and damp straw. But you could make a face out of the shadows. Only each time you looked, the face was different. Somehow you could tell he was up to no good. And you could tell that the big man didn't know he was there. But the woman did. Anyway, so, yeah, so there's this weird dynamic going on with these scarecrows. It takes him a while to realise that they're wearing the clothes from the mill, but he does, and he kind of pushes them down in a rage. But the man and the woman at the front kind of fall into a way that sort of looks obscene to him, as if they're having sex in the field. And he kind of runs away from them and finds Mr. Merciful again, who ends up telling him the story of the mill and the miller. Which is a sordid tale.
Yeah, it's like the kind of thing that would have been recorded in a murder ballad.
Definitely.
Back in the 16th century.
Yeah. It says, so it's basically, it's that there's an old miller and a young miller, and the young miller inherits the mill from his father, but he doesn't have the desire or aptitude to run it, so he brings in this man called Starkey. And Starkey was robbing the young miller from under his nose, and kind of everyone knew it except the miller. And he also got close with the young miller's wife, Josie Cragg, and eventually the young miller sort of cottons onto this and comes over and confronts them, and then he disappears and the mill stops working. And it sort of a couple of weeks later, the mill's kind of being reclaimed by the authorities. And they crank up the big water wheel, and it says, "Up came young Miller, 3 weeks dead. Jammed into wheel he was, and went round three times more before they stopped it."
and then the police are summarily sick.
Yeah. and in the end, both Starkey and Josie are hanged. He at Strange Ways in Manchester, and her in Holloway in London. Yeah, that's the grim tale of the miller, now they're sort of inhabiting these scarecrows,
motivated by pure hate. I like that they don't really seem to have any agenda apart from to be hateful.
Yeah, It says, the scarecrows were hungry to live again. They lived on their own hate for 30 years, and it was a thin, bitter, unsatisfying thing, like endlessly drinking vinegar because there was nothing else. The dead, Simon knew now, were always hungry, and they felt entitled. They were coming to prey on the fatness of the living, and he, Simon, had opened the larder door, and it could never be closed again. So yeah, just some real malevolent, scarecrows.
Really nasty scarecrows.
And then, just getting towards the end of it, then Tris LaCharge.
It is really funny, right? Because you would think that was like the setup for the book.
Yeah,
we're near the end now.
We're near the end. This friend of Simon's from school turns up. He's a joker. We saw him at the beginning at the book. He's kind of diffuses Bowden's bullying by making everyone laugh, and he kind of turns up again just to be a general chaos gremlin. I think because Simon's mum thinks that having Tris around will help Simon, which seems like it.
And also maybe she just fancies, she's like, "Oh, Simon's such a drag. At least his friend Tris is fun. I'd rather have him around."
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of Simon sort of moping, being like, "Oh, why do they like Tris the more than me?" And you're like, "Well, Simon, let's be honest here, mate."
Yeah. Tris starts up the old mill again, just for a lark, bringing it closer to the brink of destruction. And Simon thinks that for some reason that the scarecrows are scared of Tris. Maybe his general chaotic demeanour, I don't know.
Yeah, it's quite odd because this seems quite key to the ending of the book and the book's last line.
Yeah.
Right? So I guess Triss is on the side of, like, life and chaos, and the Scarecrow's on the side of, like, death and... I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure how it works, but...
Yeah. Or are they scared of Triss because Triss has, like, nearly destroyed the mill and they're tied to the mill? I'm not sure.
Maybe.
But...
The Triss only does that on a whim.
Yeah.
He's just like, yeah, let's pull this lever. And suddenly all these TV crew are around, which it's quite an unexpected turn of events in this book.
Yeah, well, Triss, after nearly destroying the mill, gets Joe to, like, call the National Trust and say, like, and be like, look, we have this really, like, old mill, and it's, like, in really bad disrepair. But maybe, you know, you should come and conserve it or something. And it becomes this kind of cause. And once the National Trust get there, and then all these TV crews come up and start sort of digging up the sordid history of the young Miller and Starkey and Josie Cragg. And
which is just what those Scarecrows want, possibly.
Yeah.
And, maybe,
yeah.
They want to be on TV, I guess.
But yeah, with all this tension, they start moving closer and closer to the house. And after some time with this, Joe puts on a kind of haunted house that he does.
I mean, this sounds great. To be fair, and, you know, if I was unsure about Joe, definitely a redeeming moment, I've got to admit. His house is
cool.
Apparently rigged up to allow him to do strange haunted house activities, which wasn't mentioned before, but okay.
No, this is just, among his skills, he's doing this, doing this haunted house ghosty thing.
Him and the rest of, well, Simon's sister and his mum, they all go upstairs to be monsters.
Yeah. And it kind of, they're sort of doing this, and they've got all, like, lights rigged up and sound and everything. Then things sort of start to get weird. They've got lights rigged up and sound, but it starts to flicker and kind of bump in ways that those that it isn't meant to. And then the scarecrows are out the window, and there's a deep voice that says,
"I will be master in my own house."
And it's not Joe's voice. It's I presume. Well, I don't know. Is it Starkey? Or is it the young Miller?
Yeah, well, it's clearly a discussion between the ghosts or the scarecrows of Starkey and the old Miller. Battling for supremacy over the farmhouse.
Simon feels like he realizes he has to run. Has to run out into the field.
Into the turnips.
And kind of fight them. I'll just read a bit of it.
It becomes quite strangely impressionistic. The last 10 pages of this book are quite feverish.
I'll just read some of it to kind of give you some idea. It's kind of, okay. He ran, smashed through the hedge as if it was a rugby pack, felt the branches clutch at his shirt and tear away despairingly. He darted between the figures of the scarecrows. Starkey was still lurking at the back. He almost ran into him, into the filthy smell of rotting straw, but swerved just in time. The turnip leaves, full of rain, lashed his ankles like whips and threw wet up his trousers. He trampled on the rounded bodies of the turnips as if he was in a black room full of hard, solid rugby balls. He didn't run for help to the village. He had the ball. Nobody else could carry it now. He was alone. Nobody backing up. This was how it felt to be alone. Not terrible, but marvellous. This is how Father must have felt, driving his jeep at the Flossies. Father hadn't really been lonely. He'd simply been alone. He felt one with his father at last. Head straight for what you're scared of, Simon. It will usually run away if you do. If not, you're no worse off. With Father there, he no longer cared if he lived or died. He was panting now, great gouts of breath. Panting in total darkness, but still running, running for the mill. And somehow he knew, in all that turnip-filled darkness, just exactly where the mill was. If he was tied behind beyond hope to the mill was also tied beyond hope to him. It couldn't escape him, no more than he could escape it. I'm now worried that Flossies is some sort of obscure slur that I've never heard of before.
Yeah, I don't know.
the pitfalls of this book.
I like the phrase turnip-filled darkness.
Yeah. That's good, isn't it? So yeah, he's running into the turnip-filled darkness.
I've got no idea. I mean, look, I've just got adjective the having the qualities of floss, downy, light, fluffy.
Yeah.
We'll assume it means that. Let's hope.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just go with that. And yeah, he's kind of running into the mill, running at the mill, throwing himself at the wooden lever, kind of making the mill run.
Yeah, it makes it sound like he's sort of spearing himself from the lever, like it's like a sword and he's impaling himself.
Yeah. And he kind of... And the mill can't withstand the force of the... Of being turned on for the... Again, do you want to read that bit though? It's like there came a crack that made him turn.
Okay, yeah. There came a crack that made him turn. Then a series of sounds like sheet lightning. A whole snapped beam of timber, sharp as a lance, speared upwards through the roof, sending a patch of tiles up into the air like birds. The windows burst out in hails of shining silver like snowflakes. And then the roof fell in. For a moment, the gable ends towered clean against the sky like bishop's mitres, and then they too fell inward. Water spurted, bursting out, finding new channels, making new waterfalls that changed under his very eyes as more and more of the mill fell. Every time masonry choked it, the water burst out again into new place. There were pools forming, through which great bubbles of cloudy, flowery air burst out, as if something was drowning, and then, with a last rumble, the mill dam itself was breached, the wheel fell, and water covered everything in a huge spreading black pool that lapped gently around Simon's feet. The bubbles and ripples continued a long time, and then were still.
Yeah. So he had his final showdown with the mill, and then he has his final showdown with the scarecrows, and he kind of topples them and is kind of channeling, he's like avenging his family as he topples the scarecrows.
Which I don't really get, to be honest, because Simon's largely been the one who's given his family a hard time.
Yeah.
Like, avenging them against what? Against himself?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
This is for all the stuff I did to my family.
Yeah, it seems important to him.
Running at these scarecrows in a rage is definitely important to Simon. I agree with that.
Yeah, and it seems to give him some kind of I don't know, not closure, but something closer to a truce with Joe. And that he's kind of avenging a scarecrow for Joe as well, in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's so funny about this book is there are these moments where, maybe especially as an adult reading it, you got to step outside Simon's... I mean, it's not first person, it's third person, but it's so bound to Simon's experience. There's sometimes where you just sort of sit outside of that, and because it's not obviously a supernatural book. And you just sort of picture this wildly angry 13-year-old, like, throwing himself with rage against some scarecrows.
Yeah. You know.
But it works for him.
Yeah.
And it's cheaper than therapy.
Yeah, scarecrow therapy. Which you absolutely mangle some scarecrows. Yeah, I don't know.
Get it on the NHS.
Yeah. That's what the NHS will be soon.
Oh, God.
Just go and hit some scarecrows.
And the scarecrows are mullered, as it were.
Yeah. And then he wakes up in a turnip field, a symbolic turnip field.
Do you want to read the last few lines of this, the amazing last line of this book?
Simon, we've been worried sick. We've been searching for you everywhere, said Mum. Hello, you great turnip, said Triss Lachard.
Hello, you great turnip. Ah.
Ah. Yeah. I mean, what a strange book.
Okay, so Simon needs to accept that after all, he is the turnip.
Aww. He is the turnip.
Consider the turnip.
because he is in the field that belongs to Joe.
Okay.
And
he, Well, so this is him taking his place as like one of Joe's sons, like a turnip son. I am the turnip son.
Yeah. But also maybe it means he has turnip friends. Maybe he's not alone because the turnips are friends.
Oh, what? So he's just finally lost any type of reality and he's just going to think he's friends of turnips. maybe. I mean,
yeah.
Because I was sort of trying to think, oh, okay, is this sort of about embracing positivity? And, you know, because Triss is at least a kind of cheery fellow. And it's like, well, it's not really, though, because the end of the book is Simon kind of angrier than ever, taking hold of his anger and letting out on some scarecrows. It's not like he makes friends with the scarecrows.
No.
I don't feel like Simon's especially positive at the end. And also, like, there's the line about Joe, when he says he's, like, avenging Joe, which is all well and good. But then he says... Joe had a right to live too. And you're like, okay, very merciful, Simon, a right to live. Not maybe a right to Mum, Jane or Triss, but a right to live. Like, what? Okay, well, he doesn't deserve to be dead, but stay away from my mum and sister and my friend.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of feel like Robert Westall's kind of... given us this, well, you kind of feel at the end like he's kind of cooked you a nice dinner and said like, look, isn't this a nice dinner? And then you just like look at the plate and it's just like, it's no like nuts and bolts and like a pencil sharpener. You're like, is this a nice dinner? I don't
know what to do with this. Because it seems like a psychological journey has been gone through, but to what end, I have no idea. Does Simon leave this book a self-actualized young man, or a boy who believes he is friends with turnips. Is that the best way to be self-actualized? I've got no idea. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you were equally perplexed by this, because I was worried that I just didn't get it.
No, Ren, I mean, to be fair, the last line of this book is, "Hello, you great turnip," said Triss Lechard. The end.
Yeah.
I think that's possibly the most inscrutable. You know, I've read Samuel Beckett, right? I think that's genuinely more inscrutable, a last line, than I've read in anything by Samuel Beckett.
Sorry if we sounded like completely baffled and bemused and befuddled throughout this entire episode.
Yeah, because we are. This book is freaking weird, and it won the Carnegie Medal.
It did, yeah.
Like, it's like if someone was a really good painter and then, yeah, just painted like a side of gammon, like waltzing, like with, I don't say a new, that's a line of surrealist art, just painted like a side of gammon. Yeah, and then you're like, well, yeah, you've done it really well, but why? And I don't know. It's like there's something getting to grips with, like, a lost, angry young man in this, but there's also a lot of turnips. So anyway, if any listeners really like this book, and not that I really disliked it, I just frickin' don't know. If anyone, like, gets this last line, is like, well, obviously, hello, you great turnip. Like, how are you not getting this, Adam and Ben? Please just email us or something.
Yeah, no, please. It's stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Like, we would absolutely love to know.
Because no idea.
Yeah.
Right. So hopefully the next book we're doing is going to be a bit easier for us to get our befuddled heads about.
Yeah, I think so.
It's about creepy dolls, right?
Creepy dolls, yeah. I think that's and I think it is actually about creepy dolls. Like, I think they turn up quite early.
Oh, good. It's not called like the creepy dolls and then they turn up right at the end as a symbol for anger.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, hopefully that made more sense to you than it did to us.
If you got through this, it's weird episode. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can find their details in the show notes. You can email us at stillsayerpodcast@gmail.com if you have any suggestions for books you might want us to cover. And you can rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or things like that. And we did actually recently discover
some really nice reviews on a random website.
Yeah, but they were like from years ago, so I'm sorry that we didn't actually see them. But thank you to the kind person in Dublin, I think it was, who said that they listened to our podcast when they were going to sleep.
I'm like, I know, can you imagine listening to our voices when going to sleep?
Yeah, and just me like cackling like a demented crow. Like, I don't.
Amazing.
Like, but that's very sweet of you, so yeah. Thanks.
ASMR, I guess.
Sign off. Yeah, do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah, go and make some old fashioned expressions at some turnips, creepy kids.
Yeah. Yeah. See you next time, creepy kids.
Bye.
Bye.